This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations appear to be on a downward trajectory in the United States, as the Biden administration remains confident that it can reach its target of vaccinating 100 million Americans in its first 100 days. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said new variants of the virus threaten recent gains against COVID-19. The CDC leader said not wearing masks and participating in in-person social gatherings have contributed to the variant spread. Walensky said that infection levels are back to pre-Thanksgiving numbers, and the daily death total is expected to follow the decrease in infections. Britain's health chief is hailing a new study suggesting that a single dose of the Oxford-AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine provides a high level of protection for 12 weeks, saying it supports the government's contentious strategy of delaying the second shot so it can protect more people quickly with a first dose. Britain's decision has been criticized as risky by other European countries, but Health Secretary Matt Hancock said Wednesday that the study backs the strategy that we've taken, and it shows the world that Oxford's vaccine works effectively. Hancock's comment came after Oxford University released a study showing the vaccine cut transmission of the virus by two-thirds and prevented severe disease. For details on much more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. Also, on the VOA mobile app, via remote, this is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden renewed his commitment Wednesday to send $1,400 checks to millions of adult Americans to boost the country's coronavirus-ravaged economy, but he said he was open to Republican demands to tighten restrictions on who would get the money. In a call to Democratic lawmakers in the House of Representatives and later at a White House meeting with a group of Democratic senators, Biden called for quick passage of his $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package that includes the stimulus checks, pushing aside a call by some Republican senators for a more limited $618 billion deal. The Biden measure includes billions for vaccine distribution and other medical equipment to fight the pandemic. His proposal also would hike the national minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $15, which most Republicans oppose. Senate Democrats on Tuesday put Biden's $1.9 trillion package on a track for fast passage, likely with little or no Republican support. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Wednesday that the United Nations would work to mobilize key international actors to pressure Myanmar to make sure that the country's military coup fails. Myanmar's military, the Tat Mada, seized power Monday, declaring a year-long state of emergency and detaining de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and President Min Aung, among others. The coup took place following days of tension between the military and the ruling National League for Democracy, which won the November elections. The Tat Mada has refused to accept the results, alleging massive election fraud. Guterres said, if anything, the leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, was too close to the military, defending its brutal offensive against Rohingya Muslims that caused nearly a million of them to flee to neighboring Bangladesh 3 years ago. Two administration officials have said the United States will take action against those responsible if these steps are not reversed, while continuing vital humanitarian and development programs. Internet providers in Myanmar, including state-owned telecom MPT, were blocking access to Facebook owned services in the country on Thursday, days after the military coup occurred. Myanmar's Ministry of Communication and Information said Facebook would be blocked until February the 7th for the sake of stability. Authorities say the people behind who are troubling the country's stability are spreading fake news, misinformation, and causing misunderstanding among people by using Facebook. For more news, join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Browns, reporting remotely. This is VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A verdict is expected today in the war crimes trial of a Ugandan LRA commander.
The Lord's Resistance Army, led by Joseph Kony, is implicated in widespread atrocities first committed in the conflict in northern Uganda, then in other parts of the region. So it's a hugely significant case.
Today is day three of the trial of a Sierra Leonean for war crimes allegedly committed in Liberia. There are calls to do away with Zambia's defamation law. We'll examine the impact of mining on an Ivorian community. And today is International Cancer Day with a special focus on Kenya.
My breast developed some lumps, and before the lumps developed, I had a feeling of fatigue. I had lost weight. So even when I was going to see the doctor, I was not going to see the doctor because of the lumps, but because of the way I had lost weight.
And we'll tell you why Cameroon farmers say they are helpless. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A verdict is expected today at the International Criminal Court of the war crimes trial of a Ugandan Dominic Ongwen, a commander in the Lord's Resistance Army, the LRA. Elise Kepler is associate director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She said Ongwen was known as one of the more ruthless commanders of the LRA.
This case is hugely significant because it is the first trial leading to a verdict of a Lord's Resistance Army leader anywhere in the world. And as I'm sure some of your listeners know, the Lord's Resistance Army, led by Joseph Kony, is implicated in widespread atrocities first committed in the conflict in northern Uganda, then in other parts of the region, Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic. So it's a hugely significant case. The case has gone on for about 4 years. It started in 2016, and both sides have made their case, prosecution and defense, and it's ultimately up to the judges. I wouldn't want to predetermine or attempt to predetermine what they will say, but we will be watching closely to see how this trial concludes.
You know, Elise, before I even go into the case itself, Dominic has been referred to by some as an alleged perpetrator and a victim of the same offenses. What exactly does that mean?
It's a really important point. So Dominic Ongwen, in addition to being an alleged perpetrator, is also a victim. He himself, the Lord's Resistance Army was known for abducting children and recruiting them, forcing them to fight and commit abuses. And Dominic Ongwen was one such victim, abducted, believed to be at around the age of 10. It is then believed that he stayed within the Lord's Resistance Army and moved up the rank. But it does point out some of the complexities of a situation like this. You know, Human Rights Watch takes the position that the fact that one may at one time have been a victim cannot be a basis to negate responsibility if it should exist for the commission of crimes committed as an adult. But it is important that people not be tried for crimes committed under the age of 18 for these types of crimes. And that also one's role as a victim can certainly and probably should be a factor in any sentence if someone is convicted.
Elise, as you know, it takes two to tango, and the LRA will say that they were fighting against a government in Uganda, like President Museveni's government. So I'm interested in first knowing who brought the case against Dominic to the ICC, and what happened to the other side of the equation, meaning the Ugandan government and any alleged atrocities that the government military might have committed.
So the case came about because the Ugandan government asked the International Criminal Court to open an investigation into crimes committed by the Lord's Resistance Army. The International Criminal Court ultimately opened an investigation into all crimes committed in northern Uganda during the conflict, because the ICC isn't limited to one side or another, and in fact, it shouldn't be. The International Criminal Court issued 5 arrest warrants for 5 Lord's Resistance Army leaders. 3 have since been declared or presumed dead. Joseph Kony, the leader, is still fugitive on the run. The International Criminal Court hasn't ruled out the possibility, but has signaled that their evidence doesn't point to the level of crime that would fall kind of within the focus of the International Criminal Court during the relevant time period. And I think it's really important to note here that the International Criminal Court's work really begins in 2002, but of course the conflict in northern Uganda started much earlier. And it has been cited that some of the most known alleged abuses by Ugandan armed forces did happen before that 2002 period, which may be some explanation as to how this has unfolded.
Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with us from New York. The alleged war crimes trial in Finland of Sierra Leone enters its third day today, Thursday. Gibri Ilogima Masikwai was senior commander of the Sierra Leone Revolutionary United Front rebels that fought in Liberia alongside Charles Taylor's rebels from 1999 to 2003. Alan Werner is director of Civitas Maxima, a Finnish-based organization that has been providing legal representation to Liberian and Sierra Leonean victims of war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Mr. Masakoi is from Sierra Leone. He was actually a ranking member of the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front, a rebel movement during the Sierra Leonean Civil War. He cooperated with the International Tribunal. He was a protected witness. He gave information to the prosecutor of the special court in Freetown. And as a result, he got a relocation to Finland. And what we learned through investigation is that at some point he went to Liberia because his armed group, the RUF, was known to collaborate with Charles Taylor, then president of Liberia. And then allegedly in Liberia, he committed serious crimes.
So why is he on trial in Finland? I mean, where does the legal authority lie from Finland?
Yeah, this is a very good question. This is a relevant question. So what happened is that as a result of his collaboration with the Special Court of Sierra Leone, the Special Court of Sierra Leone had an agreement with some countries for the relocation of what is called insider witnesses. So witnesses who collaborated with the Office of the Prosecutor of the Special Court. In those arrangements, an arrangement was found with Finland, and as a result, Mr. Masakoi was relocated to Finland. So he was living for many years in Finland, and his residence in Finland gave the jurisdiction to the Finnish court.
I'm sure many Liberians will be asking this question, why Mr. Masakoi and not those Liberians who played prominent roles in the Liberian Civil War?
Yes, absolutely great questions. The first answer to that question is for the Liberian politicians who have not implemented the recommendation of the TRC for 10 years now. So the TRC Truth Reconciliation Commission came in 2009 and recommended prosecution and war crime courts in Liberia. And for 10 years now, many, many victims in Liberia are waiting. So this question is for the Liberian politicians. As far as we are concerned with a Liberian organization on the ground, Hassan Biliti and others in Liberia, we are investigating everywhere we can. So there were two trials in Philadelphia. There is now a trial in Switzerland. We hope soon a trial in France, a trial in Belgium. So actually, it's not only Mr. Masakoi. There are several Liberians under investigation from different war factions. So this effort is ongoing, but you're absolutely right, and I agree with this. I mean, justice should happen in Liberia, and this is up to the Liberian politicians and the Liberian civil society to push for it.
I'm sure you are aware that there is an ongoing debate in Liberia to set up a war crimes court. Did I read somewhere that this trial is also going to move to Liberia?
So this is groundbreaking. This has not happened before. The prosecutors, the judges, defense lawyer, the Finnish will entirely relocate the court. This will happen in 10 days, and they will move to Liberia, to Monrovia, to hold hearings in Liberia and hear witnesses for several weeks. And not only that, they will directly move to Freetown, Sierra Leone, where they will hear, we understand, defense lawyer of Mr. Gibril Masakoi. So this is absolutely right, and this is historical. That means that technically, there will be a war crime trial happening in Liberian soil very soon, except that it will be held under Finnish law by Finnish judges.
Alain Werner is the director of Civitas Maxima, a Finnish-based organization that has been providing legal representation to Liberian and Sierra Leonean victims of war crimes and crimes against humanity. You're speaking with us from Finland. There are calls by some in Zambia to do away with the country's defamation law. In the latest case involving the law, police arrested two individuals for allegedly insulting President Edgar Lungu in violation of the law. Linda Kasonde is the executive director of Chapter One Foundation, an NGO that protects human rights in Zambia. She says the defamation law has been weaponized in Zambia, and it could get worse as the country prepares for presidential election this year.
There are two types of criminal defamation in Zambia. We have the crime of defamation of the president and ordinary criminal defamation of anybody else. And these laws have been on our statute books for several years, decades in fact. But in the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen an increase in the number of cases of criminal defamation, particularly defamation of the president. And it appears that that crime is being weaponized to curb dissent in the country, in Zambia. So Zambia is heading towards our general elections in August 2021. So it's no surprise that we're seeing an increase in the number of these cases, because it's used to try and deter people from expressing their discontent with the worsening economic and political situation in our country. And I do agree with the sentiment that it is time to do away with these archaic laws. Only serve to infringe on the right of freedom of expression and ultimately on the right of citizens to freely participate in our democracy. So it's long overdue to have them overhauled.
There are some Zambians who think that some people are slandering others in the name of freedom of speech. And they also say it's un-African to defame others.
Well, there is a remedy for people who are defamed. I mean, don't forget, defamation shouldn't just be about insulting somebody. It should actually be trying to redress falsehoods that are being spread about a person that damage their reputation. But the crime of criminal defamation goes beyond that in our country. So I hear the argument that it's un-African, but these laws also originate from colonial masters in England, who at some point also thought that having criminal defamation was a useful law. And now they don't think so anymore. So things evolve with time, attitudes change. And as has been expressed by many people before me, people in public office need to have a thick skin. And if you shield yourself from what the ordinary citizen is saying, you'll find yourself, you know, living in a glass tower or walking around with no clothes on.
In the United States, Linda, it is a high bar for a public official to prove a defamation, let alone the president of the country. But what do you make of this arrest of two individuals who were arrested for defaming President Lungu?
Well, I mean, as I said, there are several people who are currently facing charges of criminal defamation. Personally, if somebody has been defamed, my view is that civil defamation claims are sufficient to redress any harm to anybody's reputation. So there's no need to infringe on somebody's liberty by pressing criminal charges against them.
Linda Kasonde is the executive director of Chapter One Foundation, an NGO that protects human rights in Zambia. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 4th. Today, Thursday, is World Cancer Day, set aside to raise awareness about cancer and encourage its detection, treatment, and prevention. Cancer is the third leading cause of death in Africa after infectious and cardiovascular diseases, according to the World Health Organization. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, cervical cancer is the leading cause of death in Kenya.
African continent bears 80% of cancer burden as only 5% of global resources are devoted to cancer. This makes the continent's cancer incidence projected to grow to over 85% by 2030. In Kenya, out of the 28,000 new cancer cases recorded annually, 78.5% of the victims do not survive. At the Kenya's Kenyatta National Hospital, the top five killer cancers in the country are cervical cancer, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, chronic leukemia, and stomach cancer. Rhoda Mwangithuo is a 58-year-old Kenyan diagnosed with breast cancer 10 years ago. She never knew that what began as fatigue could lead to breast cancer. She, however, says she had noticed a swelling on her breast, but ignored until she started losing weight drastically.
My breast developed some lumps, and before the lumps developed, I had a feeling of fatigue. I had lost weight. So even when I was going to see the doctor, I was not going to see the doctor because of the lumps, but because of the way I had lost weight. And the doctor felt the pimple, and he advised me now, it is not about fatigue or loss of weight. First of all, go and have a scan done. And actually, after the scan, the two lumps portrayed themselves very well on the scan. So he read the results. I was confused. We didn't talk. And yes, I was booked for surgery. I was operated on, the whole breast removed.
Another Kenyan, Ralph Chege, has survived colon cancer. He narrates how he lost hope when he was diagnosed with the disease in the year 2018. He even wrote his own eulogy and a will. However, a successful treatment which led to the removal of some part of the colon has saved him.
I contracted colon cancer. I went through the four stages, that is the medical part, the radiotherapy, the chemotherapy. I knew I have no chance for survival. But nevertheless, my wife, my family, they gave me a lot of hope. So at the back of my mind, I knew I was going away. One time even I was tempted in the bedroom to write my eulogy, and I wanted to also to write my will. But my wife came around and took on the phone and told me, you're not going to die. Be strong. I was moving to stage four, and now here I am, the source of encouragement, and I am strong. They have checked every part of me, and they have found I'm quite okay, and I am cancer-free.
Nancy Mwanza is a widow, left with two children, lost her husband to acute leukemia, a type of cancer of the blood and bone marrow that affects white blood cells. She recalls the last moments with her late husband.
I remember the first days when he was admitted. He was very hopeful. He gave me hope. But when he went to India, now that's when things started becoming bad. I remember he stayed in India. The first 3 weeks, he was not treated. We had no money for treatment at that time. Later, his friends came to our rescue. They fundraised and he started chemo. I never thought he could go, but I wanted him to live. If not for me, then for my children.
Nancy's life has not been easy since the husband died. She says nursing a cancer patient is so overwhelming, and she could not believe her husband died barely 6 months after diagnosis.
2019 was a very, very tough year. I was so angry at God. I felt like he was punishing me. Dennis did not deserve to die. I hated seeing couples, seeing families. I could not even attend a family days in church. I just became alone. I wanted to be alone with my kids. I just want nursing a cancer patient. If mine didn't make it, it doesn't mean that theirs will not.
On the other hand, Dr. Mary Nyangasi, head of the National Cancer Control Program in Kenya, said that the country has decided to create awareness since majority of Kenyans show up late for screening.
Currently, around 70% of our Kenyans present in stage 3 and 4. We have realized that awareness, information, and knowledge about cervical cancer and cancer in general in our setting is minimal. Stigma is one of our biggest challenges in terms of mobilizing communities to screening. So you find 70% of our patients coming for treatment when they're already in advanced stages of the disease, meaning chances of cure are very low. So what happens is that majority of cancer patients currently will die.
Cancer kills more than 500,000 people each year in sub-Saharan Africa. According to World Health Organization, cancer is the second leading cause of death globally. It is approximated that 70% of deaths from cancer occur in low and middle-income countries. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
A group of activists and community members in Ivory Coast has filed a lawsuit against the Ivorian government for allegedly facilitating environmental and social damage. The Similimi community wants a place surrounded by forests and clean water is now 100 meters away from a mining pit. The case was filed in the ECOWAS Court of Justice by Ivorian organization, the Group for Research and Advocacy on Extractive Industries, along with partner group Advocates for Community Alternatives. Jonathan Kaufman, founder of Advocates for Community Alternatives, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the case.
You kind of go out the other side of the village and you get onto the big, enormous piles of tailings. There's explosions, bulldozers going everywhere. This is a community that should have been relocated years ago and the people should have been properly taken care of. But instead, they've just been neglected and abandoned. And the results to them are pollution of their water. And so the people are drinking water that's getting them sick. There's stories in the village of children who have died from drinking contaminated water. They've lost access to their land. They have lost their cultural sites. So the shrines that they used to pray at and conduct rituals at in, you know, on the hills and in the forest have been completely destroyed. Over the years, the government and the company have always said when we push them, oh yeah, we know about Similimi, we know they need to be relocated, but they point their fingers at each other. The government says company's job, the company says that the government has to do it, and as a result, nothing gets done. So finally, the people at Similimi have had enough. They've done their investigation, they've collected evidence, they discovered the mining permit was renewed in 2018 despite all of their complaints. They believe that it's a joint responsibility of the company and the government to compensate them for what they've lost and relocate them somewhere where they can be safe and live a dignified life.
To give context for how the Court of ECOWAS Court of Justice has done on these cases in the past, why do you think this is a good route to address this issue?
The ECOWAS Court of Justice has the ability to pass judgment on the ECOWAS countries, which includes Cote d'Ivoire, so almost every country in West Africa. All countries in West Africa have sworn to uphold those judgments and carry them out. And it has jurisdiction over human rights issues. And the ECOWAS Court actually has a history of taking these kinds of cases seriously. They've passed down judgments against Nigeria for massive pollution in the Niger Delta. We've used the Ivorian legal system to get documents that were previously not made public that showed the lack of planning and the lack of preparation of environmental permitting documents that should have been done before the permit got renewed.
You know, what kind of needs to be done on the ground in these countries to ensure that these kinds of extractive industries don't kind of act first and then the only route to justice is, you know, after the fact?
Because this is a lawsuit against the Ivorian government, right? It's not a lawsuit against. So what we're basically saying is that in most ways, the Ivorian government failed to regulate. It goes a little bit further than that, because in one case, the Ministry of Environment actually stopped Onjuku Manganese from working because of all of the environmental damages and the lack of environmental plans. And the Ministry of Mines literally came in and countermanded that order and wrote the company a letter that said, oh, you can keep on working, no problem. So it wasn't just a failure to regulate. It was like there were some proactive things that the government did to make it possible for this company to do what it's done. But you find that in Cote d'Ivoire and in a lot of countries along West Africa, the laws are really good. They incorporate international rights standards. They require environmental impact assessments. The community is supposed to be consulted. It's supposed to be brought on board. All of these things are supposed to happen. But then when you get down to it, governments move mountains to allow mining companies to do what they're going to do. So what we really want to see through this case is an impetus to governments to take their own laws seriously.
That was Jonathan Kaufman, founder of Advocates for Community Alternatives. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Accra, Ghana. And that's it for this Thursday, February 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
On this edition of Press Conference USA, host Carol Castiel and VOA's Daybreak Africa host James Buddy talk with Judd Debremont, director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, about prospects for a more dynamic Africa policy under the Biden administration. Listen to Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.